Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the health of college and university students. And certainly it is true that going back some way, administrators in higher education have been concerned with the health of their students, although over time the issues have changed. In the 1800s, for example, administrators were worried about drinking and gambling and consorting with prostitutes. Today, certainly sexually transmitted disease does remain a concern, but school officials also find themselves confronting a range of mental health issues, including things like depression and eating disorders. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about the history of college health and perhaps also the way that college health services have influenced American society in a larger sense. And our guest is Heather Monroe Prescott. She's professor of history at Central Connecticut State University and is the author of a recently published book that is titled Student Bodies, The Influence of Student Health Services in American Society and Medicine. Her book is published by the University of Michigan Press. She is also the author of an earlier book that it looks at the history of the development of the idea of adolescent medicine. And the title of that book is A Doctor of Their Own, The History of Adolescent Medicine. And as you can tell from the titles of these two books, one of the things that she's very much interested in is the history of medicine and public health. So as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome from listeners. The only thing that we ask is that callers try to keep their questions, comments brief, just so we can keep and get in as many different people as possible. But again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Prescott, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
And when we talk about this history, and I say something like, you know, I think in my promo I said something like colleges and universities have always been concerned with the health of students. Really, though, that what we're talking about a concern that's been demonstrated in an organized way maybe for a couple of hundred years, going back to the 1800s, I suppose.
Yes, that's correct. And really with the expansion of higher ed following the Civil War, interest in the student body has increased as well, and that coincides really with the expansion of public health and the rise of scientific medicine in the United States as well. So I see changes in medicine and changes in higher ed kind of going hand in hand.
Yeah. There are a lot of interesting things here, and I suppose one of the basic things is the differences between the ways, at least initially, colleges and universities thought about their male students and their female students. And this indeed goes back to this idea, and perhaps it's an idea people are familiar with, that there would have been a time not all that long ago where where physicians and other people argued that education was not good for women. In a truly physical way, it was not good for women.
That's correct. In the 19th century, physicians, probably most notably a Harvard physician named Edward Clark, theorized that education literally damaged women's bodies by drawing energy away from the reproductive organs in particular, led to menstrual difficulties, cramps, and ultimately infertility. It sounds ridiculous today, but in some respects, it's a variation on what President Summers at Harvard said about women not really being capable of education, although in this case, the physicians and to some extent professors and administrators were arguing that education actually damaged women's physical and mental health.
Mm. And so for that reason, people who were interested in the education, promoting the education of women, thought that this was something that they really needed to take into account. So in a way, and we can talk about men in a moment, but in a way that they did not do for men, they were concerned about at least the physical health and the fitness of their female students.
Exactly. Those who supported women's education found themselves having to address this argument about the potentially damaging effect of higher education on the female body. So one of the things that in particular women physicians and physical educators at the women's colleges and coeducational universities found themselves doing is promoting preventive health, physical education, on the one hand to prevent disease and disability, but on the other hand to empower women and to build up their physical stamina and physical fitness to really make them better citizens overall. And in some respects, they were kind of forward-thinking and anticipating some of the things that we're saying about student wellness and physical fitness today.
Mm-hmm. And also, they were, in a way, unlike men, they were concerned with where women were living, how they lived, and so for that reason, they felt that it was important to provide university-sponsored and monitored housing for women, something that they did not do for men, at least not at this time.
Correct. In fact, again, it comes out of this notion that women need protections from not only from the damaging effects of higher education, and I would say that even supporters of women's higher education on some level bought into that or at least had to acknowledge it, just if only to reassure critics and, of course, parents who were sending their daughters to colleges and universities, but also a recognition that living away from home was, in some real sense, dangerous to young women. This was a time when women who were alone in public were seen as not terribly respectable and were vulnerable to sexual predators and other unsavory individuals. So, and on some level, giving protection to women was a way of acknowledging that women were more vulnerable to violence and other kinds of social disorder.
Yeah. And certainly now we do have the idea, colleges and universities do have the idea that in some sense they are responsible for the well-being of students. They're in some sense they are standing in for parents. And this does go back some way, at least as far as women are concerned, but this has not always been on the agenda of the universities.
Exactly right. And when we talk about the notion of in loco parentis or the institution acting in place of the parent, that concept was really applied to women before it was applied consistently to men. Partly because of the notion that in some cases men were able to take care of themselves, although if you look at the reality and some of the things you mentioned in your promo about drinking and gambling and going to prostitutes and other types of stereotypically male behavior, concerns were there, but there didn't seem to be as much interest or willingness to regulate male behavior in the same way that there was the cultural need and to regulate female behavior.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Heather Monroe Prescott, is a professor of history at Central Connecticut State University, and she's particularly interested in the history of medicine and public health. And we're talking a little bit about what you can find in her recent book, Student Bodies, which takes a look at the growth and development of student health services on university campuses and what that meant for the students and perhaps also what that meant in a larger sense for society and for medicine. And the book is published by the University of Michigan Press. Questions, of course, here on the show. Welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit about. Are you still there, Professor?
Yes,
Prescott?
I am.
Okay. Well, there seems to be quite a bit of crackling there on the.
The connection kind of fades in and out.
Okay. Well, we're talking about the fact that that there was a time, certainly there was a time in the 19th century, when people made this argument that too much education was hazardous for women. Very specifically, it was hazardous for their reproductive systems. And for that reason, some people discouraged too much education for women. Interestingly enough, there is a somewhat parallel concern also at this time about the effect of academic work on men.
Exactly. And the argument is that men are spending too much time in sedentary occupations. The nature of male work has changed, so there's more men working in offices, working in business, spending long periods of time sitting around and not engaging in exercise. And the fear there is that white middle-class men are falling behind physically, immigrants, working-class men, African-Americans. So there's a certain anxiety about the weakness of the middle-class white male body that's also driving concerns about physical fitness and health.
Yeah, so that is why at this time, for both men and women, colleges and universities start to have physical education departments, and they start to require PE for students.
Exactly right, and some of this comes out of statistical data collected during the U.S. Civil War, which found that some genuine evidence that in fact physical fitness was not very good among various sectors of the population, particularly those who are engaged in sedentary occupations.
And I guess part of this whole concern maybe about physical fitness, but generally about health care for students, at least health care for men, was bolstered by the fact that around the time of World War I, when they were trying to find men who were fit enough to serve, they found that very high numbers of college-age men were rejected on the basis of some kind of physical shortcoming.
Right, exactly. I think it's I'll have to go back and look at the specific figures, but of those who were not disqualified for various reasons because they were married or had dependents or things like that, those who actually showed up for physical examinations, about one-third were found unfit because of either physical or mental problems, whether it be, this is when the first IQ tests were being implemented, so because of mental deficiency, because of various disabilities, chronic illness, and so forth. So that was a real concern that came out of the First World War, and then, of course, that also coincided with the 1918-1919 influenza pandemic, which also brought home, like nothing else, the need for emergency medical care, of course, but also medical care more broadly, and preventive measures for preventing the spread of epidemic disease.
Mm-hmm. As you explained, colleges, universities were, again, we're going back to this time, we're talking about the 1800s, were particularly concerned with the health and the safety and the welfare of their female students. So for that reason, women were required to live on campus. They had dorms for women. It was not the case, at least initially, for men. They were essentially on their own. They, unlike the women, they lived off campus. When did the idea of dormitories for men come along?
Well, it really varies on the campus and the situation. In my book, I have an interesting case study that examines a epidemic of typhoid fever that occurred at Cornell University in 1903. And that event brought home, like nothing else, really, the vast disparity between protections for female students and male students. The students who lived off campus, the male students, that is, were much more likely to contract typhoid fever than female students who were required to live on campus and had a food service and water supply that was regularly examined by the campus public health officials. So parents started to suggest that, well, you're protecting our daughters, why aren't you protecting our sons? And I have one interesting quote from one mother who said, why should we continue to send our sons into danger? Why isn't Cornell doing more to protect the health of our sons just like they protect the health of our daughters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you present these two cases, one about this outbreak of typhoid in Ithaca at Cornell, and there was another case involving Philadelphia where there were very, very serious outbreaks of infectious disease, and that hit college students very hard, or they were among the groups that were hit hard.
Right. In Philadelphia, they're kind of interesting case studies because Ithaca's a rural campus and Philadelphia is an urban campus, and in Philadelphia, the concern was the encroachment of the immigrant population and African American population on the physical space of the University of Pennsylvania. And at one time, one reformer referred to Philadelphia as Filthy-dalphia because of the high rate of infectious disease and lack of basic sanitary and preventive measures preventing waterborne diseases like typhoid fever or cholera or respiratory illnesses of that sort. In fact, University of Pennsylvania had one of the highest incidents of tuberculosis among college students of anywhere in the country, primarily because of the living situation of the students. Hmm.
It was true that administrators were concerned about what their male students were doing in their off hours, and that there was concern not only just with their physical health, but perhaps also their moral health and the impact of things like drinking, gambling, and consorting with prostitutes, the impact that that had on students' physical health. How did administrators think about that, and particularly what did they think that they could do or should do?
Well, in this sense, some things have changed and some things have not changed so much. The materials that I've looked at have flip-flopped between trying to take more responsibility for supervising student behavior and also realizing that male students in particular will only put up with so much regulation of their personal life. And part of the reason that in the 19th century male colleges and coeducational institutions took a kind of hands-off approach to male student behavior is because earlier in the 19th century and even in the late 18th century, male students had rebelled against various rules regulating their behavior, including beating up their professors, rioting, and so forth. So college administrators decided, well, we'll just let the students fend for themselves. We're not going to bother with regulating unruly male behavior because it's just not worth it. And what really started to change things partly is because of parental pressure and competition among universities and colleges for male students as the number of institutions expanded and as institutions like University of Pennsylvania, for example, wanted to attract a broader student population from across the nation, not just from the greater Philadelphia area, they found themselves having to provide these kinds of services to attract students and also to reassure parents that their sons were being taken care of. And I think also there's changing notions about the nature of male adolescence and early adulthood. There's a notion that on some level male students are not quite mature enough to regulate their own lives and that they also need some kind of supervision in loco parentis as well.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the fact that there was certainly for a long time kind of a double standard in the ways that administrators thought about these health issues as they applied to their male students and their female students. You also do talk some in the book about those colleges that have been historically served African-American students. How did the issues play out in black colleges? And essentially, was it the same as those where white students attended?
There are some similarities and there's some differences. For female students, because of racism, because of, in particular, racist notions about female African-American sexuality, black colleges, particularly black colleges for women, found themselves having to combat those stereotypes while simultaneously also having to deal with concerns about the effect of higher education on women's bodies. And so they really had to struggle to overcome the notion that black females were inherently more sexual and more deviant than white females. So they cultivated perhaps even more restrictive rules in terms of regulating student behavior than did the white women's colleges. And for men, these institutions were also combating stereotypical notions about black men as well. And so partly because of racism, partly because of health disparities even among middle-class African-Americans, health problems were more prevalent because of lack of adequate health services, segregation in particular in the Southeast, lack of availability of adequate health care. These institutions found themselves needing to address pretty serious health issues much earlier than institutions serving primarily white students. Hmm.
We're just about at our midpoint here of this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Heather Monroe Prescott. She's professor of history at Central Connecticut State University. And in her work, she's interested in a number of things, including the history of medicine and public health. She is the author of the book A Doctor of Their Own, which takes a look at the history of adolescent medicine. And more recently, the one here we're talking about, the title is Student Bodies, the Influence of Student Health Services in American Society and Medicine. And it's published by the University of Michigan Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There certainly was a time on campuses, and particularly I guess this would apply to male students, when if students got sick, they were essentially on their own. They were expected to go out and find a doctor if they needed one and to pay for the doctor out of their pocket. When did colleges, though, begin to decide that they needed to provide medical care for their students, actually to have physicians available and to have a place where if students were sick, someplace on the campus they would go and know that they could be seen by a doctor?
Well, it really depends on the institution. And one of the factors influencing all of this was opposition from the mainstream medical profession, which did not want to see colleges and universities having a monopoly on medical care. So very early on, starting as early as 1900 at the University of California, for example, you saw local physicians opposing what they called socialized medicine or monopolies on medical care. So colleges and universities that set up student health services on campus found themselves being criticized by local physicians claiming that they were monopolizing medical care, that they were not giving local physicians an opportunity to treat patients, although to treat student patients, although in a lot of cases, particularly at state colleges and universities, this is before private health insurance, of course, students couldn't pay for medical care anyways. And so colleges and universities realized that if they were going to retain students, particularly students who were on scholarships or who needed to work in order to support themselves while going to college, they needed to provide health services, but they were also facing opposition from physicians who saw this as unfair competition.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I want to make sure that we talk about is the issues that are raised, but that you deal with in the book and that are raised by the subtitle about, well, how it exactly did student health services influence the way people in the United States thought about health and medicine. Did the growth of student health services in this sense, the sense that there was a health center on campus and there were doctors there who were one way or the other in the employ of the university and the students went there when they were sick, did that have some effect on the way people thought about the notion of the availability of health care and who should have it and in what way should it be provided and all of those things that we're still now talking about today?
Yes, exactly. One of my central points is that in many ways student health services served as a model for what we now call managed care or group practice. Some of the earliest examples of group medical practice, in fact, were at some of the larger state universities and private universities, University of California being one of the major ones I looked at, as well as Cornell University. Large institutions with large student populations and, of course, more assets than some of the smaller universities. And, in fact, during the 1930s, during the Great Depression, a group called the Committee on the Costs of Medical Care did a study of various options of group practice, various ways of financing medical care efficiently, and student health services were one of many types of group practice that they studied.
We have some callers to bring into the conversation, so let's do that. And we'll start with someone in Urbana, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes, go ahead.
You mentioned at one point in the conversation that administrators were concerned with the effects of higher education on women's bodies. Now, there's an interesting angle I never heard mentioned. What sorts of things are involved in that consideration?
Well, it sounds to us today to be quite off the mark, quite far out. But the theory basically was that the human body was a closed energy system, that there was only so much energy within the body. And in terms of the female body, if too much energy was used with what they called brain power, then there wasn't enough energy to supply the rest of the human body, particularly the reproductive system. And they were concerned about the impact of excessive brain power, as they put it, on young women who were still developing. The average age of college students at that time, female college students at that time, could be as young as 16 or 17 years old. And because the average age of menarche and physical development was somewhat later than it is today, there was concern that using your brains too much during puberty and late adolescence was particularly dangerous for young women.
Thank you.
All right. And again, we talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but I think it's a point it's interesting to underscore. For that reason, there were people who thought, yes, it was good for women to be educated, but you had to pay particular attention to their physical health. And for that reason, women, college students, it was emphasized that they get exercise and that they also take care of themselves and that they slept and that they ate well. And for that reason, the first student housing that was provided by universities was provided for the women. They didn't care as much about the men, but as you discussed, there was a parallel kind of concern that if the men spent too much time studying, they would weaken as well. So for that reason, administrators embraced this idea of physical education for both men and women. And the idea being that if you spent all your time with your head in the books, that it wouldn't be good for your body. So a healthy mind and healthy bodies were both concerns, and they felt that both those things needed to be addressed.
Exactly right. And there's some concern about what at some people called at the time the crisis of masculinity, that college men were falling behind working class men, immigrant men, African American men, other racial minorities in terms of their physical fitness, their physical bodies. And probably the epitome of that notion was Teddy Roosevelt, who was a college athlete who promoted what was called the vigorous life, the rigorous life, the strenuous life, and believed that young white males were falling behind in terms of physical competition. And this is also the era when the modern Olympics came about, and the United States, like other major nations, were concerned about their military strength, their ability to compete both metaphorically and literally in terms of the physical body.
Okay, let's talk with someone else. This is Champagne in line two.
Hi.
Hello.
My question is really one of context. Currently on the U of I campus, there is a movement to start up a women's center to look after the physical, emotional, and mental well-being of female students on campus. And I'm very interested in what the historical context or groundwork for that kind of movement is.
In terms of the recent past, the notion of women's—we've had a women's center here at Central Connecticut State University for a little over 30 years or more. Part of that was prompted by health activism by women students, women faculty, and women staff, in particular, disparities in terms of reproductive health care. And what I mean by that, of course, is availability of contraception. There was a time in Connecticut not long ago that contraception was illegal, even for married women, and it's really only very recently, since the 1970s, that contraception has been available for college women in terms of U.S. law, but also in terms of willingness of student health centers to provide it. So in some sense, there needs to be recognition, just going along with what I've said earlier about the 19th century, in some sense, there has to be recognition that there are health needs based on gender, that women have health needs that men don't, and vice versa. One thing that needs to be recognized also, that in protecting women's student health, we need to be careful not to replicate the double standard that used to exist, where protecting female student health also meant curfews, dorm mothers, and that sort of thing. There needs to be some equity on both sides.
Sure. It seems like having a general health center on campus almost eliminates that argument that it's some zero-sum game, in my mind, but I would be interested to hear your feedback on that. But also, I've heard the argument framed in the context of, in fact, I think an administrator had stated, well, you know, there was a time and a place for women's centers to come about, and that time has passed. And so I'm actually curious to know if that is, in fact, accurate. Are there new women's centers, you say, you know, in your home university that there, and I apologize, I don't remember, but that it started 30 years ago, and so now that, you know, there's perhaps a, you know, a big revolution, you know, in the 70s and the perhaps even in the early 80s has passed. Is there still active movements going on? Is that something that's still happening? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Oh, okay. Let me see if I understand your question correctly. As the time for women's centers passed, and if so, what should we substitute it for? And if not, what are some of the issues? I guess I'll address the second part of that first. There still is a need for providing affordable contraception for young women and for young men, for that matter. But because most of the contraceptive methods are aimed at women, particularly hormonal contraception, the patch, the pill, NuvaRing, and other things like that, providing affordable contraception for young women is still something that I think needs to be done in college health centers. And what's happened recently is the cost of contraception, particularly the birth control pills, has skyrocketed with changes in federal law regarding pharmaceutical companies and providing contraceptives to college health centers at cost. They used to be able to do that. Now they have to. They can't do that any longer. I think there are issues, though, that of male students that I don't think are adequately addressed, and I don't think that's the fault of student health services, but rather I think it's the notion that for so long women have taken responsibility for contraception, that because of routine screening for cervical cancer and so forth, women have been encouraged and conditioned to go to the physician on a regular basis. And I frankly feel that there needs to be some attention to male health issues, the case of Lance Armstrong and testicular cancer, for example, in young men is a good example of how there needs to be some awareness to young men and their health needs. And then, of course, there's also the standard health issues that affect both men and women, particularly in terms of alcohol and other types of substance abuse. And of course, mental health issues, which have, this being slightly after the one-year anniversary of Virginia Tech, makes us all very familiar with the lack of adequate mental health services on college campuses.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Heather Monroe Prescott. She's professor of history at Central Connecticut State University, and she's the author of the book Student Bodies, The Influence of Student Health Services in American Society and Medicine, and it's published by the University of Michigan Press, which takes a look at how over time colleges and universities have thought about the health of their students, what was really important, and what kind of services the university felt bound to provide for students. She's also the author of an earlier book that it looks at the history of adolescent medicine. The title of that book is A Doctor of Their Own. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Something else I think is interesting, perhaps you could talk a little bit about it, is that the fact that because universities decided that they wanted to provide health services to their female students, and because they thought that it was maybe not appropriate for young women to be examined by a male doctor, that college health services actually did something in terms of providing opportunities to women physicians for work.
Exactly right. And historically, if you look at the history of women in medicine, like women in other professions earlier in American history, women physicians were a small minority and discriminated against in terms of employment. So working as a college physician for female students was one of the few occupational opportunities for women physicians. And women physicians took on the care of women and children and other areas in which they felt welcomed and felt particularly qualified because of their status as women went into these particular fields. And I think also women physicians, having been educated in colleges and universities and medical schools, also felt that they were role models for the healthiness and well-being of the female college students, so that they were, examples of how a woman could be both highly educated and healthy and in terms of both physical and mental health.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back and talk a little bit more about student sexual behavior and concerns of administrators about that, there certainly was a time when the administrators were particularly concerned about their male students and their sexual behavior, who it was, whether they were having sex and who they were having sex with. But certainly it's not very long before we get into the point where the administrators are starting to become concerned about their female students being sexually active. And if we're talking about here coeducational institutions, we're talking about the male students and the female students having sex with one another. So here, particularly, then we get into concerns about sexually transmitted disease and contraception. When did really colleges and universities start to think that this was something that certainly students had to be educated about, but that that in a sense that the university had a duty or responsibility, that it was a need to actually provide services for contraception for their students?
Well, there's really two questions here, I think. One is, when did colleges and universities find it necessary to educate students about sexuality, and when did colleges and universities feel compelled to offer contraception? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay, so in terms of sex education, you see that first coming into being in the 1920s, at least at some institutions. One of the issues that came out of the First World War was concerns about what they called at that time venereal disease, what we call sexually transmitted diseases. One of the findings during the First World War was that there were high rates of sexually transmitted diseases among college-age men, not necessarily college men, but men within that age group. And even though the incidence of, at that time, syphilis and gonorrhea were the two most common sexually transmitted diseases, even though the incidence was very low among college students, maybe less than 1%, I think it's something like 0.5% or something like that, the fact that any college students at all had these sexually transmitted diseases raised concerns about the sexual knowledge of young people. And some of the more progressive institutions believed that they should end what they called the conspiracy of silence about sexual matters. This is still an era, even in the 1920s, of censorship, debates about sex education, even for adults, let alone individuals in their late teens and early 1920s. And so what you saw happening is that some colleges and universities, and this was funded by both the Rockefeller Foundation, which was a major foundation in medicine and public health at that time, as well as the YMCA, the YWCA, and other nonprofits, pushing for more sex education in colleges and universities. But much like the controversy about sex education in high schools today, that was certainly controversial, and so the push for sex education met with a counter-resistance from more conservative individuals.
I wonder if you engaged at all along this point, particularly, let's say, before World War II, if you engaged administrators in some conversation about student health and you said to them, well, why do you think that it's important that you are concerned with the health of students, that you're promoting their health, you're trying to provide them with education and perhaps also health services, would they say, well, we're doing this for A, the good of the college, B, the good of society, or C, the good of students? Or would they opt for all of the above?
I think they would opt for all of the above, and it really depends on what type of institution you're talking about. If you're talking about public universities such as University of Illinois or Central Connecticut State University, which at that time was earlier was a normal school for teacher training, the argument would be that if we were going to make our institutions accessible to all people and to train individuals for careers to help our state and larger society, we have to make sure that these individuals are healthy. In the case of normal schools, for example, making sure that future teachers are healthy so that they can withstand the stress and strain of the teaching profession, that they don't have chronic diseases that they'll pass along to their students, that they learn healthy behaviors that they can also pass along to their students. And so in the public universities, there's a sense that protecting the student body and preserving student health is for the greater good of society, because these individuals will go on to promote public health in the state and the larger community. And you see that to a certain extent at private institutions as well, although at the same time you also see elite institutions such as the Ivy League and some of the elite women's colleges also trying to use physical health and ability to also to weed out what they called less desirable individuals. And there's a certain degree of racism and, at that time, anti-Semitism going along with this. And there's linkages between certain ethnic groups and certain types of physical illness. For example, Jewish students were seen as being more vulnerable to various psychological illnesses, much in the same way that you see some stereotypes about the mentally ill today.
Hmm. Well, that gets at something that we hadn't touched on, and I want to at least have the chance to raise. And I don't know if there's anything more to say about it, but that is that there are some ways in which these concerns about student health were actually used to screen people out. And I don't know to what extent people were doing any kind of pre-admission kind of screening, trying to do an assessment of students' health and using that as one of the factors that they'd taken into consideration when they're deciding whether to admit that student or not.
Right, exactly. I mean, some universities decide that, well, we can't afford to offer health care, or we can't be bothered to accommodate students with physical disabilities, with chronic illnesses that need regular treatment or monitoring, so we're just going to exclude them entirely. And, of course, what's happened over the past 30 years with American disability law and access to higher education is that argument just doesn't wash anymore. But, yes, earlier in our history, unfortunately, bodily defects of various kinds were used to weed out certain individuals. But also, on the brighter side, most universities and colleges had some kind of entrance exam, partly so that they could improve the health of the individual student. So in some sense, physical education and health monitoring was more individualized than it is today, that particularly student health services at more wealthier institutions were able to offer a much more individualized program of physical education and health promotion than we are today.
We have about 7-8 minutes left again in this part of Focus 580. He's talking with Heather Monroe Prescott. She's an historian at Central Connecticut State University. She's interested in the history of public health. Her most recent book looks at student health services and their history and the impact of student health services on colleges and university campuses and what that's meant for American medicine. Student Bodies is the title of the book. Certainly now, today, the student health services have to deal with an enormous range of things, the same things that they always have, their concerns about students' general health. Are they taking care of themselves? How are they eating? Are they getting enough sleep? Are they overindulging in alcohol? There still is the concern about sexually transmitted disease and also about, communicable disease, infectious disease, because students live very closely together in dormitories and they're in each other's faces a lot. And so that's an ideal condition for people passing around colds and flu and a lot of other things. But on top of all of this, it seems that there is a growing concern about student mental health and about this being a new challenge for universities to meet as students seem to, in greater numbers, come already having some kind of history of mental health issues and possibly taking medications for that. At what point did colleges and universities start thinking about providing mental health services for their students?
Well, the earliest ones were in the 1920s and 1930s. That was another outcome partly of the First World War and the high incidence of what they called shell shock at the time, that previously mentally healthy individuals under the stress of combat exhibiting mental health problems. And some psychiatrists and other mental health experts who served in the military during the First World War began to promote a idea that the best way to prevent this type of combat fatigue or shell shock was to provide more preventive services in colleges and in primary schools, secondary schools, and other institutions. So in the 1920s, there was a movement called the Mental Hygiene Movement that wanted to increase preventive services for individuals, particularly young people, which they believed to be most resilient and most receptive to preventive measures. At the same time, there was also a movement against abuses in mental hospitals and asylums, and those the preventive issues and the reform issues kind of went hand in hand. And so you saw campus health centers beginning to offer mental health services as early as the 1920s, usually at institutions that had more money, such as Dartmouth College was one of the earliest, Princeton, Harvard University, some of the wealthier women's colleges. But then gradually some of the state universities also began to hire psychiatrists or psychologists, and those that had medical schools or clinical psychology programs associated with them grew the fastest.
It seems that now certainly one of the big issues is, how do you balance, on the one hand, say if you're a college or you're an administrator, how do you balance, on the one hand, your concern for the health and well-being of individual students and with the community, the university community as a whole? How do you balance that against your respective individual students' privacy and how it is they live their lives and what kind of issues they bring with them and who it is that needs to know about that? Was that something that always, that at least going back to the 20s, was something that was an issue?
Yes, indeed. And one of the things that disturbs me about, particularly about what's happened in Virginia following the shootings at Virginia Tech, is there seems to be a weakening of the privacy rights of individuals with diagnosed mental illnesses, and that's something I could probably spend an entire broadcast on. But prior to the passage of the Family Education, I forget exactly what the acronym stands for, the Family Educational Rights, Privacy Rights, or something like that, in the 1970s, college physicians, psychiatrists held no restrictions really but were much looser in terms of transmitting information about a student's mental health, in particular to deans, future employers, parents, of course, and so forth. And it wasn't that long ago that homosexuality was considered a mental illness and a reason to disqualify somebody from service in the military, certainly, but also applicants to the Peace Corps, individuals who wanted to serve in civil service jobs, FBI, and so forth. And so I've found cases at some of the Ivy League schools where campus psychologists or psychiatrists would tell potential employers that an individual was homosexual or that an individual had some other mental illness. Again, homosexuality was considered a mental illness at that time, and use that as a way to disqualify a certain applicant for employment. So I'm hoping that what's happening today in terms of changes in disclosure of certain information will not go in that direction. I'm hoping that disclosure of a person's mental health history will be confined to those who need to know, insurers, members of the health staff and so forth, and it won't be used as a way to profile and track individuals with mental illness.
We're just about at the point we have to stop. We have about a minute and a half. Just very quickly, you talked about a couple of ways in which student health services perhaps had an impact on medicine in a larger sense. One would be in creating opportunities for women to have careers in medicine. The other perhaps would be contributing to greater acceptance among the general public of the idea of getting their health care in a kind of a managed care sort of a situation. Is there any other way in which student health services really affected the way people think about health or medicine?
I think in larger terms, what educating students about health-promoting behaviors and the need to provide equality of access of care has done in over the course of the 20th century is to help promote the notion that public health is and access to medical care is a right, not a privilege. Now, whether that has been fully implemented, of course, is something that we're debating today. But as I call one of the chapters in my book, one of the things that campus health centers have done is to sell hygiene or to sell the notion of preventive health, healthy behaviors to not just to college students, but also to the general public by educating students to be advocates for public health measures, for health care reform, and so forth. So that's what I see as the biggest impact over the course of the last 100 years is to serve as advocates, not just for the health of students, but for the health of a larger community.
Our guest, Heather Monroe Prescott, professor of history at Central Connecticut State University. Her book is Student Bodies, The Influence of Student Health Services in American Society and Medicine, published by University of Michigan Press. And Professor Prescott, thank you very much.
Thank you.